It was Wednesday, April 20th, and there were five of them in Morgan 412. Utrina was lying on her bunk, reading for GH204. Caitlin and Miki were on the piano bench with a notebook between them, doing the final timing for the impending Institute Symphony Orchestra spring concert. Azalin was lying on the floor, studying for her organic chemistry final, and Wakaba was looking through the photo albums again, and snickering at the pictures of Corwin, Utrina, Corwin's uncle, and Corwin's uncle's car, all in various states of disrepair. Up on top of Caitlin's bookshelf, Tiny Robo and Lesser Mazinger were playing what appeared to be Gin Rummy with a tiny deck of cards Devlin had found somewhere. As Azalin glanced up from her reading to check on them, Tiny Robo slowly and magnificently laid down his cards, then folded his arms and, with a rather satisfied tone, announced, "Grr." Lesser Mazinger looked from his opponent to the cards and back once, twice, then threw his own hand down in disgust, gathered the cards together, and started shuffling them again. Azalin chuckled. "Hey, you guys," she asked the others suddenly, "are you all set for the spring formal?" "Huh?" said Utrina, who hadn't really been listening. "I'm sorry?" said Miki. "The what?" said Wakaba. "Oh, that's next weekend, isn't it?" said Kate disinterestedly. "What?" Azalin burst out, scrambling to her feet. "None of you are ready?" "Ready for what?" asked Utrina. "The spring formal. Only the most important dance of the year. It's on the 30th, a week from this Saturday. Kate, I'm shocked. You didn't tell them a thing about it."
Slipped my mind, said Kate. "I'm not going, after all."
"Formal dance, huh?" said Utrina. "Not my style."
"You're not going, Caitlin?" said Miki.
"I don't go to dances."
"You know that, Azalin."
"But the spring formal! Everybody goes to the spring formal."
"I didn't go last year," Kate pointed out.
"You were sick last year," said Azalin.
"No, I wasn't. I just said that so you'd quit bugging me about it."
Azalin put her hands on her hips and tried to look furious.
"Caitlin Yuriko Hutchins," she declared, her tail twitching in annoyance. "You ought to be ashamed of yourself, lying to me like that. This year you're going. Tvil na jai."
"I don't have anyone to go with," said Caitlin, unconcerned. "I'm not going."
"Oh, no, you don't. Miki!"
"Yes?"
"Ask Caitlin to the spring formal."
"Now!"
Miki blinked.
"Miss Caitlin, would you like to go to the spring formal with me?"
Kate looked at him skeptically, then turned her eyes to Azalin.
"Dirty pool, Az," she said.
Azalin looked smug.
"Well," said Kate after a moment's consideration, "if you really want to go, and you're not just humoring the rodent."
"I am not a rodent,"
said Azalin petulantly, folding her arms and looking away. Then she opened one eye, aimed it back at Kate, and grinned.
"Actually, I do," said Miki, sounding equal parts embarrassed and surprised. "If you really wouldn't mind."
"Well, okay," said Kate.
"Yes!"
Azalin turned triumphantly to Wakaba. "What about you?" Wakaba blinked at her, then grinned. Sounds like a good excuse to make Sayanji buy me something expensive, she said. He did say he was going to one time, but he never did. The sound of Utena slapping her forehead drew Azalin's attention to her. What about you? The Dantrovian demanded. Leave me alone, Utena grumped. I don't do dates. Wakaba snorted explosively. What the hell did she call having gone out for dinner with Corwin Ravenhair every Friday night since the last Toronto trip? Utena's glare kept her from saying it out loud, but honestly... It doesn't have to be a date, said Azalin. I'm going with Moose. I don't wear dresses, protested Utena. So don't, Azalin replied. No rule that says you have to. Wear a Starfleet dress uniform for all I care. Just go. With... Oh, I don't know, Wakaba mused. How about your boyfriend? Wakaba? Utena growled in her this-is-no-longer-funny tone, then blinked in surprise as she realized that Azalin had said it too, at exactly the same time, in exactly the same tone. Wakaba, hit with a double barrel, subsided with muted grumbling about how nobody could take a joke around here. It would be a shame if you missed it, Azalin said encouragingly. It doesn't have to be a big deal. You just go with somebody you like, look good, have fun. You're good at looking good and having fun. Utena looked as if she might protest again. Then she sighed. Does my hypothetical date have to be another student here? No, Azalin replied. Liza Broadbitch is going with some corporate weed her daddy's sending down from New Avalon. Utena sighed again, deeper this time, rolled her eyes in a put-upon manner, and said resignedly, Okay, I'll go. If I can line up somebody to go with, and I'm not going to try very hard. She gave Wakaba another warning look and said, Pass me the phone. Wakaba raised her hand in surrender, took the phone's cordless handset from its base, and relayed it via Azalin to Utena. She dialed it quickly with her thumb, then tucked it against her shoulder. Hi, Skuld? This is Utena Tenjo. Oh, fine, how are you? Great. Listen, is Corwin around? Sure. Thanks. Corwin? Hi, it's Utena. I'm great. How are things? Listen, we're having this sort of formal dance deal here next Saturday. Yeah, the 30th. It's not really my kind of thing, you know. Normally I'd just blow it off, but everybody's being a pain about it, she said, directing a half-mock glare at Azalin and Wakaba. And Kate's going, so I was wondering if you'd like to go. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, no, I don't think anybody would object. There's no rule. Uh-huh. Well, we'll figure that out when we get there, I guess. Uh-huh. Formal. Yep. I don't know yet. No, don't worry, I'll figure something out. Okay. You're coming for Kate's concert, right? Okay, then. See you Friday. Yep. Take it easy. Bye. She thumbed the phone off, plunked it on the bedstand, and said, There. Are you happy now? I'm going to the damn formal. Yay, said Azalin. She and Wakaba shared a high five. You'll really have a good time, said Azalin. I promise. And we'll all get to see Corwin all dressed up, too, said Wakaba with a grin. That ought to be worth the price of admission all by itself. I bet he polishes up real nice, she added with some slightly leering eyebrow action. Jich mudech ko, Utena muttered, returning her attention to her homework. But she was smiling. That evening at dinner, Azalin continued her lobbying efforts, having been sorely jolted by the knowledge that so many of her circle weren't planning to go. She asked around at Table 11 and discovered that almost all the duelists didn't have plans. Oh, come on, this is ridiculous, she protested. Amanda and Devlin are the only ones with plans out of all of us?
My plans, said Kyuichi Sionji dryly, seem to have been made for me.
Wakaba grinned and applied wasabi to her buttered peas, which made Miki wince.
Remember, she admonished Sionji, yellow is my color.
I haven't been asked, said Dorothy.
Nor I, Juri concurred, nodding.
You don't have to wait for the guys to ask. That kind of thing went out decades ago, said Azalin grumpily. Ask somebody yourself. Deville, Juri, all you ever do is study or spar. You should go out and have some fun once in a while. So should you, Dorothy. You want to explore your emotional horizons, right? So ask somebody to the formal. I think a date is just what the both of you need.
Juri looked at Dorothy. Dorothy looked at Juri. Between Dorothy's calm deadpan and Juri's look of very slight bemusement, some invisible communication passed.
Juri, said Dorothy in a conversational tone, would you like to go to the spring formal with me?
Why, I'd be delighted, our Dorothy, Juri replied in the same rather affectedly casual tone. The next sound was the faint slap of Utena Tenjo's forehead falling into the palm of her hand.
Well, that wasn't quite what I had in mind, said Azalin lamely.
Then she caught herself up, gathered her composure, and went on gamely,
but it's something.
Ought to raise a few eyebrows in the receiving line, said Devlin dryly.
The rolls are almost edible today, what? He observed, taking another from the basket.
I wasn't aware that there was a spring formal, said Mia Ausa thoughtfully. My calendar of activities isn't very complete.
Is that a chunk of bone, Utena wondered, or just carbonized meat?
Caitlin looked.
Carbonized meat, she opined.
Feh.
If you would like to attend the formal, Miss Ausa, Skaya Vorokoshika R. X. Tixta Kittel Tikul Ryhelt Ishkarat would be honored to serve as your escort. He grinned a scrangish grin and added, you're not the right species, but at least you have a crest.
Oh, well, thank you, Sky, if you're sure you don't mind.
Not at all. I hadn't been asked either, he added in a confidential tone, but I'm taking Azalin's word that it's acceptable to volunteer.
Well, there, said Azalin in a satisfied tone. Are we all squared away now?
Unless you wish to extend your crusade to a campus-wide matchmaking effort, Dorothy informed her, I would say your work is finished, yes.
Not with less than 2 weeks to go, Azalin replied. Might be an idea for next year, though.
The fourth term of the year at Worcester Preparatory Institute was traditionally wrapped up by a special 2-week period preceding finals week. On the Saturday at the end of the term's sixth week, the Institute Symphony Orchestra delivered its spring concert, a grand showcase of all that organization's hard work and preparation since the Christmas concert preceding B-term's finals week. This was an all-hands event, with the school's whole population invited free of charge to hear their classmates perform under the direction of the student director. At the previous years, outgoing senior Kieran Calloway, on his way to the prestigious Galactic Institute of Music on Xi'an Prime, had passed the baton to Caitlin Hutchins, the first time that honor had ever been bestowed upon a freshman. This year, after 4 months of preparation, the orchestra would perform their leader's first symphony in A. They had overcome the disruptions of Christmas break, bounced back from the loss of a dozen very talented members, including Chenan, their much-loved Minbari first cellist, and clawed their way back to an orchestra's equivalent of fighting trim. All of them were motivated. All of them were ready. No facility on campus was large enough to contain the audience anticipated for the spring concert. Unlike the Christmas concert, which was held in Alden Memorial, this one was traditionally held at the Worcester Auditorium, a massive neoclassical pile of gray stone at the corner of Main and Highland Streets. With very nearly the full student body and faculty of the Institute, a great many parents and friends, and musical types from all over the Federation, that august hall was filled to capacity when the curtain rose on Caitlin and her orchestra at precisely 7:30 on Saturday night. That part of the Institute Duelist Society that didn't overlap with the Band Geeks Federation was jammed into one of the corner boxes, almost quivering with their shared excitement. They were joined by their new faculty advisor, who raised some eyebrows and elicited some giggles with his somewhat unorthodox combination of tuxedo and warrior's baldric. Juri Arisugawa, Kyuichi Sayanji, and Wakaba Shinohara wore their Otori Academy Student Council dress uniforms, freshly pressed and polished. Skaya was resplendent in the white and crimson silks of his Scrang trading house, Ishkarat. Dorothy wore her favorite red dress. Utena Tenjo was dressed in her black and scarlet, gold braid and epaulets glittering. Corwin Ravenhair arrived tuxedoed as well, and so did Nall, his little vest and bow tie eliciting a most unseemly storm of giggling from the box. On the opposite side of the auditorium from the duelist's box, a contingent from New Avalon, many years older, experienced the same anticipation and delight. Utena peered across at them, trying to see how many she could pick out at this range. Kate's parents were there, of course, and the Roses. Marty's height and Aiko's hair made them impossible to miss. And Corwin's mother, aunts, and uncle. There were others, too, that she didn't recognize. A short woman in a Wedge Defense Force dress uniform, a tall man with craggy Nordic looks and a great sheaf of blonde hair, a bearded, red-headed man in a windbreaker, a rotund gentleman whose tuxedo made him look rather like a benevolent weeble, and a tall, slim black woman in a scarlet dress. The combination of images that last represented gave Utena a stinging pang of nostalgia, even though the resemblance was only superficial. She shook her head and leaned over to ask Corwin if he could identify the ones she couldn't. Down in the main seating sections, the faculty and student body of the Institute was packed in, interspersed with parents and friends, shuffling through their programs and discussing the show to come. At the end of row 6, an elegant figure topped with a mane of blonde curls sat silent, her arms folded. Though there was someone in the seat next to her, she was as alone as if the room had been empty but for her. Utena, scanning the crowd from her railing seat in the duelist's box, would have been surprised to see her there, except Caitlin had warned her. Elizabeth Broadbank did not participate in any of the Institute's several musical performance groups, did not interact with the Performing Arts Department in any capacity. If asked why not, she would reply rather haughtily that she had no interest in such frivolity. Her adherents would privately speculate that the truth of the matter was she lacked ability. The real truth of the matter was that, along the entire length of their history together, Liza had left music as the one neutral zone in her cold war with Caitlin Hutchins. Liza might insult her lifelong enemy. She might scheme against her. She might attack her friends and endeavor to make her leave the Institute, but she would not directly interfere with the workings of the orchestra. She had tried, rather half-heartedly, to maneuver Caitlin out of her band presidency once, but she would never try to disrupt the band itself. That would probably be a very effective way to hurt Caitlin, but it was a line that Liza Broadbank would not cross. She was here for exactly the same reason as all of her schoolmates, to enjoy the sounds of her school's famed symphony orchestra, one of the finest secondary school orchestras in the galaxy. Nothing more, nothing less. When Kate stood at the head of her orchestra, the war was suspended. It was a peculiar weakness in Liza, and she recognized it as such, but she indulged herself in it anyway. The house lights dropped, the curtain rose, and Liza composed herself to listen. She'd stopped by the windows of Alden Memorial during rehearsals a few times, and what she'd heard had been quite good. Like him or not, and she certainly did not, Kaworu had added a certain spark of something to the group.
Now, as deputy director, he stepped to the podium. He wore a notch front tuxedo with a blue rose and cummerbund carefully selected to match his hair. It made an interesting contrast alongside Caitlin's black and orange Chinese-style dress as he stood next to her and spoke for her, addressing the audience in a calm, confident manner which Caitlin could have felt, but never given the appearance of. He welcomed the audience to the 2405 spring concert, thanked them for coming, then introduced Kate and himself. "Tonight," he said, "we are very pleased to give the first complete public performance of Miss Caitlin's very own Symphony No. 1 in A, the completed score of which was awarded the Proctor's Choice Prize at this year's IRCAM Conference Internationale des Modernes Compositeurs in Paris. Of course, the orchestra will be under the direction of Miss Caitlin herself. Our soloist for this evening will be the Honorable J. Maurice McEachern IV on the Hoffman Anvil Bells, Miss Ezelin Devere Natashkin on oboe, and myself on piano." He bowed to them, then to Caitlin, and went to his place behind the concert grand. Juri Arisugawa would be the first to admit that she didn't know a hell of a lot about classical music, or any other kind, really. She lacked the understanding of the mechanics of music necessary to know if a particular piece of music was good or bad, or even to understand how or why some people drew the distinctions. All she knew was subjective, some things she liked, and some she didn't. Some music moved her, some failed to do so. As far as she was concerned, it was that simple. Symphony No. 1 in A moved her. At times tempestuous, at times ethereal, it was a piece of remarkable complexity for the youth of its composer, and it evoked something in Juri's mind, the same way Kate's piano sonata had back in Paris. She had no way of knowing if that something, those formless but powerful impressions, were in any way related to what Kate had been thinking or feeling when she constructed the music Juri was now hearing. But she felt them anyway. There seemed, to Juri, to be a powerful underlying theme of pain and redemption. The storm-tossed disorder of the first movement, punctuated by the mighty clamor of Moose McEachern's anvil bells, spoke of some terrible trauma. The second movement was dark, slow, gloomy, the lingering, gnawing agony left behind by that trauma, sharply characterized by Azalin's haunting oboe solo, which cut across the layered despair like the line of blood left behind by a razor. Ah, but the third movement redeemed it all, starting with a slow, rumbling build-up which hinted that it might herald a second blow, a final, shattering dissolution, until something bright and beautiful charged to the rescue in a welter of soaring brass and galloping piano, sweeping it all aside and gathering the whole orchestral line to its breast as it plunged forward into vindication, into apotheosis. The melody from the mournful oboe solo was reborn as a brilliant trumpet fanfare, as if to declare that the pain was not dispelled, but integrated into the whole, making stronger what it had failed to destroy. It was the ultimate defiance, somehow more powerful than a simple expulsion, as though the orchestra itself were asking, "Was that the worst you could do?" Juri glanced down the row and was startled to see tears tracking the face of Utrin Atencho. Not that she had expected the girl to be unmoved by all this. Utrin was a very passionate individual, perhaps too much so for her own good. But crying? Then Juri looked closer and saw that she was smiling at the same time, and she understood, at least partially. She smiled, and Utrin noticed her doing it and smiled back. It was, thought Juri, a surprisingly satisfying moment. The symphony finished in a towering blaze of brass and anvil bells. Raguelin, the senior representative from the beyond avant-garde École Musico-Technologique at the IRCAM seminar in Paris, had dismissed the whole symphony as hopelessly antiquated, but this part he had especially sneered at, calling it crassly emotional. Caitlin had wondered just what he thought music was for if it wasn't the evocation of emotions, and there went that hour of the seminar,
much to the amusement of Mr. J.C. Statler of the Boston Pops. Jury, on the other hand, quite liked it, and so, if the crowd response was anything to judge by, did the rest of the audience. The orchestra was, in fact, only half done with their evening's performance. The rest of the concert was taken up by shorter pieces. There were several solos, including Caitlin's piano sonata, the one she'd played in Paris, a few small group combinations. There was one rather unorthodox moment, which puzzled a good many onlookers in its setup phase, in which Caitlin and Miki Kaworu played the two parts of Miki's Sunlit Garden on the same piano. The rest were more conventional, symphonic short pieces, some historic, some original. One of the originals was a bright, cheery, heroic-sounding 5-minute fanfare, which Miki smilingly informed the audience was entitled Scarlet of the Campus, and was, of course, dedicated to Miss Caitlin's roommate, Miss Utena Tenjo. Scarlet about summed up Utena's face as this fact gained public recognition, and she vowed to avenge herself on Kate for the surprise later. As she observed the concert, from the symphony right through the rest, Jury made another interesting discovery. She'd seen orchestras perform before, but never paid much attention to the conductor. She had always thought that the conductor's job must be rather dull, and wondered precisely what the position was for. Surely a group of musicians competent enough to form a symphony orchestra could manage to keep themselves together in performance. What purpose did it serve to have a member of the orchestra who didn't play an instrument? Watching Caitlin conduct her orchestra, an orchestra personally trained by her for nearly a year, Jury suddenly understood. Kate did have an instrument to play, the largest, most complex, and temperamental of them all. That instrument was the orchestra itself. For some reason, Jury Arisugawa felt a sense of satisfaction out of all proportion to the importance of this realization, and it stayed with her for the remainder of the evening. On the seventh day, they rested. Monday brought them back to the grind, the headlong dash toward the end of the year. The early spring was beginning to metamorphose into an early summer. The beech tree in the circle in front of Alden Memorial achieved full leafiness. Devlin snuffled through 2 days of peak pollen misery before achieving respiratory equilibrium. And on Wednesday, Edward Tversky barged into Morgan 412 and announced breathlessly, "We did it!" "Who did what?" Utena wondered, looking up from where she lay on her bed, studying her galactic history textbook. "Ein and Edward! We got Durandal through! He's stable!" Caitlin blinked. Really? She inquired. "I never noticed anything breaking." Edward grinned, drawing herself up and thrusting out her chest as she struck a heroic pose. This had the effect of surprising Caitlin with a sudden, unexpected realization. Over the course of the school year, the red-headed hacker's resemblance to a young boy had more or less vanished. Improved nutrition, as measured by a high degree of Deco mooching, and the natural action of a human body passing through its 14th year, had erased her androgynous scrawniness and replaced it with a lean but definitely feminine athleticism. Edward, with her typical unself-consciousness, had failed to notice, and was still dressing exactly as she had before, in bike shorts and most of a tank top, all embellished with the pieces of a wearable computer harness that looked like it had been put together out of the contents of the dumpster behind a Circuit City, afflicted with a particularly fumble-fingered stock boy. A year ago, the effect had been that of a techno-tribal wild child. Now, well, it was somewhat different, and all of it accentuated by the fact that she didn't have any apparent idea of what had happened to her. Entirely unaware of Caitlin's train of thought, Edward declared proudly, "We kept everything under control. No outages, no weird messages to the administration, no nothing. Edward personally forged 4,279 situation normal status messages, while Ein made sure remote diagnostics told the system checkers what we wanted them to be told. It was quite a challenge."
I can imagine, said Kate dryly. So, what now? Utrina wondered. She put up her history book for the time being, sat up cross-legged, and gave Edward her attention. Well, Edward looked thoughtful. Edward is pretty sure we convinced Durandal to stick around and pretend everything's normal until the end of the school year. Then, when everybody goes home and the place is mostly shut down, we'll probably have to steal him.
Steal him? Utrina blurted.
He can't stay here forever, Edward pointed out, as though that were obvious to any thinking life form. Sooner or later, the local ops would notice his rampancy. They wouldn't be able to understand. Stupid people think a stable rampancy is impossible. She leaned forward, open palm laid confidentially alongside her face, and added, This planet is run by stupid people. Returning to her indignant posture, she continued, So it isn't safe for Durandal to stay here.
Well, okay, but how?
We'll break into Fuller Labs and take his core elements, said Edward simply, the way a normal person would have said, We'll go to the Greendale Mall and buy some shoes.
Oh, well, ask a stupid question, said Utrina.
You know, said Caitlin rhetorically, that's stealing. No, said Edward firmly. Liberation. Durandal is a fully sentient being. If he stays here, they'll shut him down. Edward and Ayn will rescue him. She nodded firmly. Caitlin shrugged. If you're sure he's stable, she said. Edward nodded vigorously. Uh-huh. Edward is sure. More importantly, Ayn is sure. Ayn is the AI expert, Edward confided. Edward is better with databases and social engineering. Corwin arrived at 8 o'clock Friday evening. As they had every Friday this term except the second, he and Utrina selected a restaurant more or less at random from the Yellow Pages and went out for dinner. As they had every Friday, etc., the others found other things to occupy themselves with and made no comment, not even Nall. It was as if the entire group had somehow osmotically learned of Azalin and Jury's truce on the matter and chosen to adopt it as a collective policy. He brought her back to Morgan Hall at 10:30, observed the grand finale of the game of three-dimensional nightmare chess which Caitlin and Wakaba had begun in their absence, and then retired to the one-hit wonder, announcing with a smile that he would be present promptly at 7 the following evening to pick her up for the formal.
You're getting a lot of mileage out of that dress, Utrina observed wryly as Caitlin fastened the 3 toggle buttons on the front of the snug little jacket that topped her orange-trimmed formal gown. For a while I thought I might never see you dressed up, and now...
Caitlin gave her a mildly reproachful look.
I liked dressing up, she said. I just prefer there to be an occasion for it. That's all.
I suppose it does give it more impact, Utrina agreed. Kate nodded.
See, now, you dress like that every weekend, so it doesn't really make an impression now.
Utrina surveyed herself ruefully in the full-length mirror on the inside of Morgan 412's door. She thought she looked pretty good. Her long, straight pink hair had grown back to just about the length she remembered it from old. It feathered around her face, brushing her cheeks gently when she moved her head, and hung in a heavy fall to the back of her narrow waist. Dressed in the trim, scarlet-accented black jacket of her old Otori Academy uniform over a nicely cut pair of scarlet dress trousers, with the thorn of the rose slung at a rakish angle at her waist, she felt she had an air that it was at once formal and slightly piratical. Unfortunately, Caitlin was right. She wore her Otori uniform as casual clothing, an everyday sort of garment, when she wasn't required to be in WPI's uniform. She didn't wear it as though it were formal wear, which had the effect of muting its formal look.
As such, her current outfit didn't give the impression that she was dressed for a special occasion, but... "Well, what else have I got to wear?" she asked rhetorically. The answer, both she and Kate knew very well, was not much. Aside from her Rotori uniforms, she owned several WPI uniforms, like every student must. Aside from that, she had only a small assortment of casual civilian clothes and a few pairs of pajamas, none of which was appropriate for the spring formal.
That is a problem, Kate observed.
She sat down at her desk, rummaged in the top drawer, and got out the minimal assortment of basic makeup gear she owned.
There's always Azaline's suggestion, she added wryly.
A Starfleet dress uniform? Utina replied, giving her roommate a skeptical grin. If I knew where to find one, maybe.
Call to Dad, said Kate dryly.
She hadn't expected her roommate to take that suggestion any more seriously than Azaline's. But to her surprise, Utina got that determined look she sometimes had, strode to the side of Kate's desk, picked up the telephone, and firmly thumbed one of the speed dial buttons. Kate sat, powder pad in hand, and gazed at her roommate with amused disbelief. He answered on the second beep, and after the distinctive chirrup of an old cybergenics flip-top communicator, Utina heard him say, "Griffin here."
"Sensei? Hi, it's Utina Tenjo."
"Well, hi. How are you? Everything's okay, I hope."
"Oh, sure, no problems. Are you busy? I hear people talking in the background."
"Not really. Just fooling around with some drive system tests." "Pipe down, you mugs."
"Captain on the phone!"
A military-sounding voice barked in the background, and the noise obediently subsided.
"What can I do for you?" asked Griffin.
"Well, we're having this formal dance thing tonight."
"Uh-huh, I heard," said Griffin, sounding faintly amused.
"Oh, sure, I guess you would have. Well, this is kind of silly, but I don't have anything to wear. I mean, I've got my old uniforms, but I wear those all the time, so..."
"Ah," said Griffin, understanding. "And you're not really the ball gown type."
"Yeah," said Utina. "I wore one once, back home, and I felt ridiculous the whole time. Azaline suggested a Starfleet dress uniform, but I think she was joking."
Griffin chuckled, then said in a slow, thoughtfully sly tone of voice,
"I don't know where I could get my hands on one of those offhand, but I think I might be able to fix you up with something suitable."
Utina felt a grin stealing onto her face. Kate's father was a lot of fun, and that tone of voice meant he was thinking up something that was sure to be amusing.
"You're at school?" said Griffin more briskly.
"Yep."
"How long have you got before Corbin comes to pick you up?"
Utina glanced at her watch.
2 hours.
"Plenty of time. I'll be right there. Griffin out."
Utina looked at the dial-toning telephone in surprise. "He's coming here?" she said. "In less than 2 hours?"
"He must be somewhere nearby."
"Oh, gee, I hope I'm not pulling him away from anything important. He said something about drive tests."
Kate nodded, understanding.
"Ah, his new ship, Challenger, launched last fall. They've been patrolling the Babylon Station construction zone with a couple of other ships because of the problems with the previous stations there, and testing the ship's systems as they go."
She grinned. "He'll probably use this as a drive test,